Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in National Security, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Sam Cantor, and today I'm talking to David Oakley. He's a professor at the Joint Special Operations University and author of the book Subordinating Intelligence, the DOD-CIA Post-Cold War Relationship. Intelligence studies is still in some ways a growing field, and is one that predominantly focuses on external outputs, so things like the efficacy of assessments, the accuracy of predictions. But obviously, just as important, and perhaps in many respects the first step towards understanding those outputs, are the internal factors, how intelligence agencies take shape and take form, the internal processes and bureaucracies that govern them, and quite critically, how these myriad of agencies interact with one another. And it's that last point that Professor Oakley's book really lives in. In tracing the post-1991 DOD-CIA relationship, he argues that national intelligence has become increasingly focused on supporting military operations, often to the detriment of larger strategic issues. Moreover, he connects this to a broader trend, the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. He is uniquely suited to tackle this topic. In addition to his academic credentials, he has extensive professional experience in both the U.S. Army and CIA. And with that, David, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, Sam, thanks for this great opportunity.
Let's start with your background a little more. So as I alluded to, you had a pretty interesting career trajectory. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how it interested you in doing this topic academically?
No, sure. You know, some people probably say I can't, you know, hold down a job, but I started off as a field artillery officer in the Army. So, you know, after college, received my commission, went through ROTC, spent about 6.5 years as a field artillery officer. And then I left active duty for a while. And during that period, I went over to the CIA and I was part of their CST program, clandestine service trainee program, within the director of operations. And so I was went through the training and the certification to become what they call a staff operations officer within the DO. A staff operations officer, you know, at the time there was three basic career tracks within the director of operations. There was the operations officer, which everyone's, you know, familiar with, the case officer, the one out recruiting spies and assets. There was the collection management officer who received the intel pull from the asset. And then there was the staff operations officer, often referred to as a desk officer, that was providing administrative support to the handling of assets from the headquarters. And so I did that, some other stuff, helped with some programs. Was at the agency for a couple of years. And then I ended up leaving. As you can appreciate, the cost of living in DC is quite high. When you have three kids, it makes it even more so. And so I switched over to the National Counterterrorism Center, where I served for about a year before an opportunity came, popped up to come back on active duty. And so then I came back on active duty as a functional Area 59, a strategist, did assignments, first at Fort Riley with 1st Infantry Division. During that time, I actually worked in the interagency again as an LNO in Baghdad, Iraq, during a deployment in 2011. After that, spent a couple years at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, going through Command General Staff College, and then the School of Advanced Military Studies, where I actually started the research on what ended up being my book. During that time, I was working on my PhD through Kansas State, and so continuing the, you know, the research towards that. After Leavenworth, I went over and I served as a planner at Army North in San Antonio, Texas, doing Defense Support Civil Authority. And then when I finally finished the PhD, was sent over to National Defense University, where I taught at a great school called the College of International Security Affairs for about 5 years. Last year, I decided to retire from the Army, left the Army and moved the family out here to beautiful sunny Tampa, Florida. And now I am associate professor at Joint Special Operations University, which is SOCOM's educational institution. We call it SOCOM's Think, Do, Tank.
Well, that certainly seems like appropriate preparation to cover this topic. So diving into this, I'd wonder if you could kind of set some context for us. Now, your book covers the post-1991 period, but obviously the DoD and CIA are both born with the 1947 National Security Act. So what do the first three or so decades of this relationship look like within the context of the bipolar strategic environment that is the Cold War?
Yeah, you know, what I found, and one of the things I probably should have mentioned earlier is kind of, you know, what drove me to this. And I'll kind of tie that back into the history of what was going on and what the relationship looked at the time. And so, you know, what kind of fascinated me when I started working at the CIA, I knew there was a shared lineage between the military and the CIA, you know, with the shared lineage of OSS. And I knew about that. What I started seeing was a pretty diverse different cultures between the two institutions. And so I started wondering, you know, how did these two institutions who are so different now culturally, how do they, you know, grow from kind of the same seed or have similar lineage, I should say. And so, you know, I started looking back at the original story of how it began. And so the story between the two really began with the 1947 National Security Act, right? That was the creation of both the Department of Defense, and the CIA. And really in the early days, you know, there was a relationship and there was some blending, and there has been that throughout their history. But what I found was the first three decades of the relationship was not, although they worked together and there was a collaboration and then, you know, there was a kind of common focus on the Soviet Union. The relationship was very much different than it was in the later years, especially after the end of the Cold War. And what I mean by different is what I found in the early days, there wasn't this, what I call in the book, a quasi-subordination. There wasn't this huge push towards the CIA providing support to the warfighter. And so why there was some familiarity, there wasn't kind of this supported effort to use military terminology. I would also say that during those years, although, you know, of course, especially early on, you had a lot of the individuals who were in the early days of the CIA who came from the OSS, which was a military organization. What you found during those first three decades, though, is there wasn't this kind of common interaction. What I mean by that is if you go into the CIA today or you come over to Special Operations Command where I work, you will, and you speak to some of the professionals, you will, they will have a kinship, a familiarity with the other organization. And so you have special operators who are very familiar with the CIA. They've worked with the CIA. And if you go over to the CIA, you're going to find a lot of CIA officers who are very familiar with the military. In fact, you're going to go over to ADMA, and you're going to see a lot of military folks. That wasn't the case in the first 30 years.
So when did this begin to change? In your book, you kind of pinpoint the 1980s and some of the reforms that took place then as a little bit of a pivot point.
Yeah, I think the story is really, in my mind, this was kind of surprised me. It's when I started doing the research, I think it's linked a little bit to Goldwater Nichols. And so, as a military officer, I was very familiar with Goldwater Nichols and the increased jointness in the military, right? And so what I wasn't familiar with was the connection between that and what was referred to back then as intelligence support to the warfighter. And so if you look in the key date I identify, and where I really begin the story, is in 1983, when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, David C. Jones, got up before Congress and said, "Hey, we have a Department of Defense, but we're really very parochial focused. The services are focused on their own equities, and we need to change this." And he was supported in his argument, with failures, such as the Beirut barracks bombing, issues that happened with Grenada. And so, as I said, I knew that story well. When I started going into the record and I started looking at some of the after action reviews, what I noticed was at the same time that Congress, or that I should say, General Jones, and then also supported by members in Congress, were calling for increased jointness within the military, there was a supporting call for increased intelligence support to the warfighter. So, for example, utilizing the Beirut barracks bombing, for example, when that occurred, there was some fingers pointed at the agency and others in intelligence community, national intelligence, for not providing the right adequate information in a way that it would enable the commander to understand the threat. Now, what happened, I know a lot of the listeners will probably be familiar with, is you after all those complaints, David C. Jones, making that complaint or observation, as to say, you have Goldwater Nichols that's passed in 1986. A few years later, in 1989, you have Panama, and Panama, although it wasn't perfect, it was much better than what had occurred in Beirut, what had occurred in Grenada. And so there was one of my favorite quotes that I found digging through a lot of the archives was actually by Congressman Ike Skelton out of Missouri, who is very well known as a supporter of joint education. His name is at the library at Joint Force Staff College under NDU, where I used to teach. Bears his name. And the quote that was fascinating, I'm paraphrasing it now. He said, we've now fixed the military problem. We fixed the military problem. Now we need to turn to the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin that he was talking about was the national intelligence support to the warfighter.
And certainly that was an illuminating aspect of the book for me. I mean, much of scholarship tends to divide the world into Cold War and post-Cold War, and we look at a lot of defense aspects through that lens, so that you demonstrate that the 1980s is actually the beginning of a pivot point was really, in my view at least, an original take on this.
Yeah, I think that's, if I look at it, that is really the gap I'm feeling. I think there was some acknowledgement and awareness that certain points like the Desert Storm wasn't an important time frame in the relationship. But what I hadn't seen in previous scholarship was that the relationship in the 80s and some of these key events that you know we all know about that drove the Goldwater Nichols, you know, was also linked to this intelligence support to the warfighter discussion.
So as you mentioned, 1991 is kind of a seminal year in a couple of respects. We have the Gulf War, which is the proven ground for a whole bunch of doctrines and technology, both military and intelligence. And then, of course, at the end of the year, you have the collapse of the Soviet Union, depriving the military and intelligence community of the number one foe for the past 40 years. So talk a little bit about that experience for both institutions and kind of the lessons learned that they took away from that year.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the pointing out those two, you know, the confluence of the two events of the collapse of the Soviet Union and then Desert Storm, I think it's very important because these really shaped the relationship. And so beginning with Desert Storm, you know, I think we forget now because we look at, you know, the 100-hour war, we looked how it turned out, right? I think we've kind of forget how controversial it was at the time. And, you know, when George H.W. Bush was making the decision to go to war with Iraq, it was very controversial. He was getting pressured by, you know, individuals like Sam Nunn, who, you know, was the head of the Senate Armed Service Committee, by David Boren, who was the head of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, really telling him to, you know, wait a little longer to allow sanctions to compel Saddam to pull back from Kuwait. And what was really driving this fear was, you know, we weren't that far off from, you know, what it had been like 16 years since Vietnam. And so there was this fear of getting into another Vietnam quagmire. There were the ghosts of Vietnam that were still present. And so why that was important is, and this is really one of the first most important things that creates this, I would say, tension that leads to tensions between intelligence and DOD a little bit that leads to change. Why that was important is when they actually went into the air war and they started bombing, there was a disagreement between the military, I should say Central Command, and the intelligence community, specifically the CIA, over battle damage assessment, right? And so because of this ghost of Vietnam, because of this fear and this desire of not wanting to go to war, the air campaign was very important because they wanted to ensure that the Iraqis were treated to a point to where you could just move through like butter, right? You could just, there would be you know, less U.S. casualties. One of the things I failed to mention, which I found interesting in the research, is, you know, the military, DOD, bought thousands upon thousands of body bags because they were fearful that we were going to have a lot of casualties. So this focus on the air war, on softening the Iraqis, was very important. Now back to the disagreement on BDA. There's this disagreement by BDA. The administration didn't want to transition from the air war to the ground war until there was certainty that the Iraqis were treated enough. But since there couldn't be any agreement, basically CENTCOM was saying that they were treated a certain percentage. The CIA was saying, well, you know, we don't assess that. We don't agree with the way you're accounting for the BDA. So this all leads to a discussion led by Brent Scowcroft, who was a national security advisor at the time. You had the CIA director, some CIA officers. You had, you know, General Schwarzkopf, General Powell. Of course, Schwarzkopf is in theater. You had Vice Admiral Mike McConnell, who would later become the DNI, sitting in there, and they're having a discussion about this disagreement on BDA. And at the end of the day, they decided to go with General Schwarzkopf's and what CENTCOM was saying and defer to the commander on the ground. Now, one of the reasons I bring that up before, besides influencing the future changes within the relationship, this created some important tension between the military and the combatant commander on the ground. And so as we know, all this concern with BDA, what ended up happening was that it was a 100-hour ground war, right? So it was looked upon at the time, like, why were we so concerned, right? But it really frustrated Schwarzkopf on the ground at the time, the commander. Now years later, when they look back on this disagreement, what they found out was the CIA was actually more accurate. But it didn't matter. Iraqis were decisively defeated. And so that was kind of the first tension within the relationship. And I'll pause there for a second, Sam.
Yeah, certainly as good a description as any as some of the effects that the Gulf War had. So as you've discussed, the BDA conflict kind of bleeds over a little bit after the war. And in this new strategic environment they find themselves in the 1990s, there seem to be two factors at play. One is the incredible resource constraints, and the second is this almost reformist zeal that we see coming out of Congress. Can you talk a little bit about both of those?
Yeah, I think the reformist zeal, I think, was tied to, something you mentioned earlier. It was tied to two things, I should say. It was tied to a desire to have some savings. You know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, there was this whole notion of a peace dividend, right? So you had this desire for a peace dividend. Where can we look to save money? Where can we consolidate? Do we still need this large national security apparatus now that the Soviet Union is gone, right? You think about kind of the attitude of the time. You think of Francis Fukuyama's book, The End of History, right? The democracies the West has won. So do you really need all of this military power? So this was driving, the financial side was driving a little bit. And then on the other side, which is, you can't really separate from the financial side, it was kind of this, you know, this frustration with the, a desire to have some savings. You know, where can we make the cuts, right? And so there was this desire to say, okay, can we have the agency and others, you know, provide more support to the warfighter so we can have some cost savings. Kind of back to the BDA thing and the relationship at that time, I think it's very important. I had mentioned that Schwarzkopf is very, very frustrated with the disagreement on BDA. After the war, he was very voiceful about his disappointment in the intelligence support that he received. And he was going out making these comments and talking about how there's a lack of national intelligence support to the commander on the ground. Now, although he was out there saying this, he wasn't really articulating reality. If you look at Desert Storm, it was actually a pretty impressive bringing together of national intelligence, of all intelligence resources to support the warfighter. So a few things as an example. This is a time when you started having joint intelligence centers. This was a time where you started having national intelligence support teams. If you look to see I mentioned Admiral McConnell, who was the J2 at the time. If you look to see what he, in collaboration with the NSA and others, what he put together to support Schwarzkopf is pretty impressive. In fact, so impressive that you had individuals like Colin Powell saying never has a battlefield commander had this level of intelligence support. But if you think back, looking back on Schwarzkopf, with the victory, Schwarzkopf is very, very popular. There was actually talk of trying to award him and General Powell a fifth star. So he's very popular. So here was this victorious hero coming back. They're doing ticker tape parades in New York. I believe there's one in Los Angeles. He just signed a book. And while all this is going on, he's very popular. He is making these complaints about national intelligence support to him. And so that piques the curiosity of Congress also, right? And so you have this dual thing about we need savings. You also have, and we can afford to have some savings. We can afford to focus domestically on the economy. And you can also do that because it's the end of the Cold War. There's no longer the Soviet threat as much. So those were kind of the two things that were driving it. And as I mentioned, it kind of came the confluence of the two things. Now, interestingly, through my research, one of the stories I found fascinating by Schwarzkopf is when he was out there saying all this stuff, you had some individuals, some congressmen who were supportive of the intelligence community who were becoming a little concerned. And so, for example, Senator John Warner, who was on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence at the time, his office reached out to Schwarzkopf's people and said, "Hey, the senator would like to meet with General Schwarzkopf because he, wants to discuss General Schwarzkopf's concerns with intelligence support during the war." What ended up happening, according to some interviews I did, was when this, Schwarzkopf's people told Warner's that the general's pretty busy and wouldn't be able to make a meeting, fit in the schedule. So Warner's office calls Secretary of Defense at the time, Cheney's office, and then all of a sudden some white space opens up on the Schwarzkopf's calendar. Before Schwarzkopf has the meeting, his J2, speaks to him and says, "Hey, let me tell you the entire story of the intelligence support to you, to the combatant commander, to the warfighter." And so when he goes in the meeting with Warner, he starts off the meeting by saying, "Hey, I've thought a little more about intelligence support to the warfighter. Maybe I was a little too critical. It was a little more than I thought, I maybe was a little wrong about it." So Warren said, "Hey, thank you. I appreciate that. Can you go out and can you tell the rest of the, everyone else, the media, that that's the case? And he's, can you correct what you have said?" And he said, he could do that. Schwarzkopf could do that. But he never did. In fact, not only didn't he say it, he actually doubled down on the criticism of the CIA and others. In fact, in his book, the one he was paid, I can't remember how many million for, but a pretty hefty sum at the time. He said that if it was still up to the CIA's BDA assessment, that they would still be waiting behind the berm to invade. And so you have this conquering hero making the complaint, and then going back a little bit to Congress at the time, Congress, especially the individuals who were cautioning George H.W. Bush not to attack, were now scratching their heads saying, why was intelligence so wrong about how long this war would be? And the intelligence folks, what they were saying was, well, we were just telling you the Iraq's capability. We weren't telling you, you know, we can only assess capability. It's more difficult to, you know, assess motivation and you know, the fight within the military. But those two things really kind of created this condition in the 90s to relook intelligence.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And that trend kind of continues as we move into conflicts like the Balkans and enforcing the no-fly zone in Iraq.
No, it does. It does. And it does continue. And you know, from my look, and what I highlight in the book, and I really credit a lot of the kind of leadership of both the Department of Defense and the intelligence community at the time. And so, you know, I mentioned Cheney earlier. Bob Gates becomes the CIA director, you know, shortly after the Gulf War. And Gates and Cheney work close together to set the conditions to ensure that they increase support. And I think my read on it, a couple things, but you know, first of all, I one of the things I like I highlight in the book is the importance of individuals. And you know, and I say that because if you look at someone like Gates and the experience that he brought to bear, in his foresighting and kind of his understanding of, you know, both politics, the intelligence community, you know, he was kind of a driving factor behind the relationship, setting the conditions for the relationship to get closer, to become stronger. And I think he did that because he realized that because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, because of this peace dividend, because of the criticisms of the Gulf War, that there had to be some changes within the intelligence community, internally driven, or they were going to be externally forced upon them. And so what I mean by externally forced, at the time, in the early 90s, before some of these changes were put into place, you had the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence both had legislation in place to change the intelligence community. And so, for example, you know, there was the proposal for the establishing the Director of National Intelligence. There was a proposal for establishing an associate director of military support, which it was established, or something very similar. I'll get to in a second, but I think Gates realized that, hey, if we don't do something, then it's going to be forced upon us. And so let us take the initiative and look at it. He had also, you know, I'll give credit to Cheney also, because Cheney realized, and was very astute, and realized after Desert Storm that, you know, there was actually a quote that he said to his intelligence advisor, a guy named Rich Haver, who I interviewed for the book. He said, "Hey, Rich, I want you to do a review of intelligence support provided to the warfighter and intelligence during, you know, the lead up to the war, because, you know, if intelligence is, you know, when politicians are this wrong, and this goes back to the body count and stuff, it's going to be looked at as an intelligence failure. And so he was astute enough to also realize, hey, we need to think about this. Those two people come together, Cheney and Gates, to really work as a team to improve the relationship between the CIA and the DOD. And as you mentioned, it set the groundwork for the some of the stuff we saw in the 90s, the Balkans, Somalia, stuff like that. And so what I mean by the groundwork, the structure, out of these, the changes, what came out of the changes were such things as the creation of the Office of Military Affairs. This was a two-star position that originally was under the Director of Operations, whose focus was on ensuring and coordinating with the CIA for that intelligence support to the warfighter. So those things were developed. And you really saw the value of that when you start to, early on, when you start to look back at, as I mentioned, Somalia, the Balkans and stuff. And Sam, I think one good example of the change in the relationship was in Somalia in 1993. One of the first casualties was actually a CIA paramilitary officer in Somalia. And the thing that was interesting about that is it was a CIA officer who was providing providing support to the military. And so, you know, where, you know, it was a CIA mission focused on that intelligence support to the warfighter, on that force protection type of stuff that was really being pushed for in the 90s. And so, or in the, you know, late 80s and 90s. And so I think that was, a great example of how this relationship changed. When you go into other places in the Balkans and stuff, you also see this relationship change, and you see more of a relationship on the ground. You see the CIA analyst involved in targeting process, stuff that you had not seen before. Now, at the same time, you have the transition around the same time, you have the transition to the Clinton administration also. I mentioned the importance of individuals a little bit ago. I mentioned Gates. I mentioned Cheney. A lot of the changes that they identified in the transition to bring the two closer together, a lot of that was, you know, in their heads. And to be honest, through the discussion that I had with Rich Haver, as I mentioned earlier, he was the intelligence advisor to Cheney. There was really a thought initially, when they first started this, that they were going to be able to carry these changes out. And so there was going to be a second term for the Bush administration, right? The Bush, after the Gulf War, very popular. So there was no expectation that they wouldn't. But of course, as we mentioned earlier, it became about the economy. It was no longer about national security. There's that famous quip during the Clinton campaign, you know, it's the economy, stupid. And so when Clinton won and took office, a lot of that thought of what they were doing with the intelligence community, what they were doing with the CIA-DOD relationship, why they were doing certain things was lost. Now, with that said, what I found interesting is even when the Clinton administration took over, and even with the focus on domestically, you still had this discussion and this push towards increased intelligence support to the warfighter. And so if you look at stuff like the National Performance Review, the Gore Commission, that focus very broadly on, you know, relooking government, they actually mention intelligence support to the warfighter. Now, in that case, it was, you know, it seems to be more of a mention out of cost savings and reduction in spending. And then one of the other important things during this period before 9/11 that I think is very important is Presidential Decision Directive 35, which what signed by Clinton. What PDD 35 said is in times of war, the intelligence community's main focus is on supporting the warfighter. Now, that is doable when you had stuff. I would say it's doable, although it was stressing an organization like the CIA, who was undergoing, you know, like 25% cuts during the 90s. But it was still doable. It was still manageable when it was these, you know, smaller operations other than war. You know, it was the Somalias, the Balkans, stuff like that. After 9/11, when war became more of a permanent fixture in American society, the focus of PDD 35 on intelligence, you know, the primary focus is of national intelligence support in the warfighter became much more difficult to the intelligence community or for the intelligence community.
And as we discussed with some of the reforms of the 1980s, your book really does a good job of identifying these trends outside of the usual epochs that we use to define these eras. But of course, we do have to talk about 9/11 and the war on terror, and there's a lot of ground, I'm sure, to cover there. But what are maybe two or three of the key takeaways of how this intelligence and military relationship solidified over the first decade of the war on terror era?
Yeah, so I think, you know, my first observation, and this is one of my key points in the book, is, you know, the decisions in the 1990s, the creation of the Office of Military Affairs, the transition to the Associate Director of Military Affairs, these structures that were put into place, once 9/11 occurred, it provided some ground somewhere to begin from. And I argue that, you know, yes, the 1990s in some regards might have been a lost decade. There was budget cut, reductions, peace dividends. But those decisions, those organizational decisions that were made, provided grounds for the foundation for the relationship to grow between the CIA and DOD after 9/11 and in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think that would be the first thing. Without that, I think it would have taken a longer time and we would have seen more friction. And so my first observation would be like we cannot ignore the value of the choices made in the 1990s. Now, with that said, I think after 9/11, you know, 9/11 really, if you look at the, you know, if you look at the collapse of the Soviet Union, and you go back to what started this discussion about the 1947 National Security Act, both the modern day Department of Defense and the CIA, they were developed and their identities were shaped by the Cold War. You know, it was their identities were shaped by the adversary of the Soviet Union. Now, with that ripped away in the 1990s, I would argue there was this kind of this lost identity, this lost sense of purpose. Not saying they weren't busy and they had other things to focus on, but there was still some grappling with, you know, what is the role after, in you know, what is our identity after the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? I would say throughout the United States, there was this kind of perspective. Now, the 9/11 and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan kind of gave a common purpose. Counterterrorism gave a common purpose. It provided a need to collaborate more. It provided a purpose on the ground. And so I would say those are the two. Now, with that said, this relationship wasn't smooth sailing all the time. It was bumpy. And I think this goes back to the importance of partnerships and relationships, or the importance of individuals in how relationships grows and changes. But, you know, if you look at Rumsfeld at the time, Rumsfeld, he had a rather tense relationship with the agency. And so you look at Afghanistan, for example, you know, the big DOD was not as ready to go into Afghanistan, and they were reliant and dependent on the CIA. And this frustrated Rumsfeld. He would often comment that, you know, the DOD was like the baby bird waiting for the CIA to feed it a worm. And he wanted to have this self-sufficiency. He wanted not to be reliant on the CIA. And so what that created was that created tension. One of the areas that created tension is when we, you know, declared, and this kind of goes back a little bit to my comment on the PDD 35 and how that was manageable until, you know, war became the norm for the United States. When they declared the war on terror, and then when they declared that the globe was a battlefield, right? Rumsfeld started making decisions and doing activity and couching them under intelligence preparation of the operating environment. And that led to some tension with the CIA because around the globe, South America, for example, there was some stepping on toes in regards to operations and not deconfliction. Now this was worked through. But the relationship was always tense with Rumsfeld. Once Rumsfeld leaves and you have individuals like Gates come in, you know, Bob Gates comes in again into the picture as the Secretary of Defense this time. You have General Hayden come in. You have General Clapper as USDI. The relationship really started to improve and change and grow. And so that was at the policy level. Now, on the ground, which I think really helped the relationship also, was you had these different institutions who were operating next to each other or relying, and there's this kind of affinity that's growing at the grassroots level, you know, and that helped develop the relationship. There's a familiarity with each other, especially when you look at organizations like Special Operations Command and the CIA, there's this familiarity. But even beyond that, you know, when you start having like crisis operational liaison teams from the CIA operating, you know, with conventional forces, this grows a relationship. And so, you know, overall, Iraq, Afghanistan, the war on terror creates a condition that brings the organization together and closer, but the foundation, I would argue, was set years earlier before the towers ever went down.
And again, that's certainly nothing if not an original thesis. So I want to ask, we framed much of this discussion and you frame much of the book within the context of counterterrorism. But now we have this so-called pivot to great power competition, or whatever your buzzword of choice is. This idea, like we said in the beginning, that a couple of decades of neglect of the threat of Russia and China, coupled with short-term budgeting decisions and a focus on ancillary theaters of operation, left us unprepared to face these nation-state competitors. So I want to ask you briefly, do you still see that narrative as true? And where do you see the DoD-CIA relationship heading in this new strategic competition?
Yeah, so I think the narrative of us broadly, you know, national security trying to grapple with, you know, great power competition, integrated deterrence, I think it's still something. I think, you know, I'm always fascinated with, you look at how organizations evolve, you look at the intelligence community evolved as response to the security environment. So I think right now we're really trying to grapple with the security environment. Now, I would, you know, from my understanding and speaking with people, you know, the relationship is still pretty strong between the CIA and the military. You know, the last 20 years, as mentioned before, strengthened it. There's components in play, the structures in play with it, where we'll keep the relationship going. Now, with that said, you know, it's not going to be, the interactions is not at the same level as it would have been, you know, during the days of Iraq and Afghanistan, when, you know, we had hundreds of thousands of forces in either of those two countries. But I think the relationship is still good. Now, in regards to kind of shifting the focus, and I think it's related, you know, and I'll use, you know, I think this is something that it's still both organizations, and I'll speak about them separately, or, you know, my observation are still kind of grappling with. So, you know, if you look back to when Gina Haspel was the CIA director, you know, she made the push and said that, hey, we need to, you know, get a little more away from counterterrorism. We need to focus more on the China, the Russias of the world. And so, you know, she started pushing them in that direction. You know, after the, you know, withdrawal from Afghanistan and some of the stuff that happens, it was always, you know, you would hear some discussions about, well, does the agency need to have more of a role? But I think, you know, my understanding is they've, you know, done a pretty good job shifting their focus. But, you know, counterterrorism is always going to, you know, it's always going to have a role, necessarily, you know, so, but, you know, just to what degree. But I think they're a shift. I think actually for the military, it's, you know, my observation, it's a little more of a challenge. And this isn't really involved in the relationship with the CIA. It's just, you know, the military has grown, the military became used to fighting wars, to doing counterterrorism, to doing direct action missions. And now we're trying to figure out what we mean by great power competition. What is the military's role in integrated deterrence? How do they go about it? And, you know, in my view, it's a much more difficult a problem. And I'm not saying that Iraq and Afghanistan and GWAT was not difficult, but I think it's intellectually different of a problem with this great power competition. And I'm curious to see how this intellectual, what I see as an intellectual challenge, you know, how DOD deals with it, and whether or not they're intellectually prepared to deal with it.
And I think we'll leave it there. The book, once again, is Subordinating Intelligence, the DOD-CIA Post-Cold War Relationship. It's available in softcover. The author is David P. Oakley. And David, thank you so much once again for talking today. For New Books in National Security, my name is Sam Cantor. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.